Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hello there, I'm Trish Smith, Global Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at Edelman, and I'm joined by Yasmin Kader, Deputy Legal Director and Director of the Trone Center for Justice and Equality at the ACLU, where she's focused on solving problems in the U.S. criminal justice system. Yasmin has spent over 30 years on the front lines of the fight for racial justice as a civil rights lawyer and public defender. I am incredibly excited to speak with her today about our Trust Barometer special report on business and racial justice in America. Yasmin, welcome to the Trust Makers.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really excited for this conversation.
I am as well. I want to jump in because I know we have a lot to talk about, an important topic and subjects. First, I shared a bit about you and who you are, but can you tell our listeners a bit more about your role at the ACLU and actually what led you there?
I work at the ACLU, as you noted, as one of the deputy legal directors. And what my role is to really lead all of these warriors for justice that work in my center who are fighting for racial justice and for major criminal legal system change. And so it is a tremendous responsibility. It is quite an honor, and it is something that I enjoy a lot. And what led me here was really, I'm going to take it back to college if I could. I'm a graduate of Howard University and Yale Law School. And when I was in school, I was surrounded by people who either themselves remembered the civil rights heroes that changed the country or were themselves on the front line of justice. And so I was really inspired to do that. So I went to law school after Howard to be able to really be on that front line of justice. And I came out and I started as a civil rights lawyer doing employment discrimination work, and it was great work. I also, though, saw what was happening in our criminal courts and just the apex of mass incarceration and the war on drugs and what it was doing to our community. So I quickly pivoted and became a public defender, where I worked for 23 years in courts across the country. I was in DC at the apex of the war on drugs. I was in New York for stop and frisk and the post 9/11 oppressive tactics. And then I was in Los Angeles for much of the same struggle against these pernicious policies. So that was what I was doing. But all the time that I was working in the courts as a public defender, fighting mass incarceration, I was watching the ACLU. And the ACLU in many ways is an organization that does broader systemic change, but I like to say is the public defender for the Constitution. So I was so heartened when I got the call and invited to apply for this job, because I knew how important it was, the work of the ACLU, and was really honored to join.
Thank you so much for that. And many of us know the history of Howard and its long legacy of graduates, also a proud HBCU grad. So definitely understand how that probably formed and informed a lot of your passion and led to this place and space today. You mentioned sort of the history of the ACLU. Can you tell me more about where you are today as an organization and the vision for today and looking ahead?
Absolutely. And as we all know, sometimes you have to look back to look forward. So I do want to talk just a little bit about its founding and how those founding principles inform the work today. So it was founded in the early 1920s, really when our country was in a place gripped by a fear that the communist revolution that we saw in Russia was going to spread to the United States. And so in that moment of panic, our civil liberties and our freedoms really paid the price. And people, communities were facing government abuse and overreach of a unique time and place. And so there was also progress happening and backlash to that progress. So we had an influx of immigrants that brought incredible talent and diversity to our country, but there was backlash to that influx. We had a rise of a labor movement, including child labor laws, but there was a backlash and government oppression and suppression of that organizing effort. And so this kind of government-sponsored campaign of terror against radicals and dissidents and immigrants and workers, that's how this organization came to be. That's how the ACLU was formed. And it was with a simple premise of protecting the civil rights and liberties of everybody, of everybody. And so that broad inclusive mandate applies today to the work that we're doing in federal courts, in state courts across the country. We're in the Supreme Court a lot, actually more than any other organization except the Department of Justice. And you know, we're in there fighting for recognition of same-sex marriages that was a major victory in the Obergefell case in 2015. We were in there just in 2022 in a major voting rights case called Allen v. Milligan, where the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Black voters who challenged congressional map that was passed by the state legislature that was not just or fair or right or consistent with the Voting Rights Act. We're in there to protect First Amendment rights, and we're in there all the time. So that's the work that we do in the Supreme Court. But when we're focusing on all the other types of work that we need to do, there's state courts, there's federal courts, lower courts, there's fighting for the pursuit of freedom and opportunity through enforcement of our civil rights statutes and our equal protection clause. And so we are across the country, we are there, as one says, we're like water on a rock, we keep going.
And we absolutely need you to keep going with all that's happening in our country and the world today. I mentioned earlier that Edelman recently released our Trust Barometer special report on business and racial justice in America. And this year's report found that people actually want their employers and businesses to commit to diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging initiatives, and that they actually see these programs as necessary and vital for successful business outcomes. What are your thoughts on this finding? For some, it might be surprising, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, given the recent backlash that we've all been witnessing and seeing.
Well, I'm not surprised at all, because I think when we commit to these principles of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, the proof is in the pudding. And much of this is dictated and noted in the report. You have more productivity. We have higher profitability. We have better overall performance of our employees. That's just facts. It's not opinion. It's not about justice. It's just facts. In diverse and inclusive companies and teams, they boost collaboration, they boost innovation and engagement. People who work on diverse teams with people who come from different backgrounds, you're going to make stronger decisions, and we're going to capture new markets. So it's not surprising to me that there's so many leaders in the corporate sector that want to be competitive globally, they want to be profitable, and they understand that to do so, you need the best workforce possible. So they both want to fully tap into the available talent, and then they want to make sure that talent comes into an environment where everyone thrives. I think that there's a little bit of a misnomer about DEI, that it's focused only on underrepresented groups, but it's about making the workplace inclusive. It's about challenging oneself. It's about increasing performance. So I'm not surprised at these findings at all.
I would agree. There's definitely a loud minority that is causing us to believe that there is no benefit, to your point. And we know that, in fact, there is tremendous benefit, and that the work works if we work it, if we remain focused on driving it. So absolutely agree with that. That being said, we know that attacks continue, and they are pushes, particularly after last year's Supreme Court overturn of affirmative action, of course, which was focused on race conscious admissions at colleges and universities. But there have been other suits filed since then for DEI policies, some saying that there's reverse discrimination. And while we know employees and other audiences want DEI programs, based upon our research, and they say that the work works, how should companies and employers think about navigating any potential legal steps or other pushbacks?
The key is clarity. The way to navigate this landscape is to have clarity and distinguish between legal practices and illegal practices. We have a body of civil rights laws that were created to prevent ongoing discrimination and ensure equal opportunity for everyone. And it's really important that despite these attacks, it's that we note DEI practices are legally protected. Practices of inclusion, of affinity groups, of bringing in a diverse workforce, of maintaining that workforce's ability to thrive. We haven't found a court that has found DEI efforts of this sort to be illegal or unconstitutional. So I think it's really important to have clarity and proceed with confidence and remain committed to fostering a sense of belonging. It's really important that we talk about these attacks. And I know that your listeners and people who are really interested in making the business case for their business. One thing that I know about that sector is that people aren't easily bullied. And so when they watch these attacks in the press, sometimes you'll see a lawsuit was filed or a letter was written or a complaint was made. But that's it. It makes a splash for a day and it goes away. Often it goes away because there's no there there. So we need to be really clear about what is making news and what is the law, and not allow our sectors to get bullied and not allow them to be, as you said, shouted out by a vocal yet frankly legally incorrect minority.
That leading with clarity and leading with courage and leading with confidence in the midst of the attacks is what's so critically important in staying the course. Yasmin, we're seeing daily some companies that are backing away from some of their commitments or removing programs, ending partnerships with certain organizations because of external attacks or pressures. What do you say to these organizations, to these leaders who are, I would say, backing down and really running away from their work?
You know, I would ask these leaders to go back to their principles of risk and risk analysis and cost benefit analysis. And when people sit down and approach this rationally and really look at the business case, it's not close. These principles, these practices foster productivity. My advice to those leaders would be to assess this as they do any other practice that they have and not give it greater or lesser attention, but really be mindful of the risk and the cost benefit analysis. And when I believe they are mindful of that cost benefit analysis, what you'll see is that we need to move forward. Many of these suits, many of these complaints is just noise. It isn't founded in law. It isn't founded in precedent. It's noise. Corporate leaders take risks all the time. This is a small one. We need to move forward.
Absolutely. And we talked about affirmative action before, and even there, that response, it was specific to certain universities.
That's correct. And we have seen some universities and some school districts really be creative and mindful of the decision and move forward in ways that they can continue to foster diversity and inclusion. They can continue to increase opportunities for people who have been historically excluded. And we've seen other universities that have run scared, that have turned their backs and have been overly conservative reading of the decision. And that's just not necessary, and it's unfortunate. So I think that that same type of boldness and creativity and progress and moving forward that we've seen with motivated universities, that same thing we're seeing in the corporate sector with companies that are really on the front line of innovation and that are on the front line of being visionaries. Those are the companies that are thriving, and those are the ones that are moving forward and not listening to this noise and not being bullied by frivolous claims.
Absolutely. That risk analysis you mentioned is so critically important, and seeing that the reward is actually outweighs the risk here in terms of the long-term impact and return on diversity, equity, and inclusion work within an organization. Would love to talk a bit then, based upon this current reality, and where we are today, where do you see the evolution of DEI in the workplace going in the coming years amidst these legal and political challenges?
Well, I'm encouraged. And the reason that I'm encouraged is because I think what we're going to see is, again, companies that see the value of these principles for everyone, that see the value of opportunity, that see the value of inclusion, that see the value of making the workplace a hospitable place, but also being competitive and getting the best talent, they're the ones that are going to stay the course and continue to rise. I am fearful for those that are turning their back on their commitments. I'm fearful because of the lost opportunity to be leaders in the sector, but also it's going to inevitably affect their productivity and it's going to affect the value of their businesses. So that's where I see it going. I see that companies that stay the course, that also commit and further recommit to these principles. I mean, this is a field that can only go up, that can only expand. You're a DEI professional. You know, there's the explosion in learning, the continued rigor that the field has of continuing to bring in new practices and new policies and just get better and better at these concepts. That commitment, it's going to, I see, really, there'll be a demarcation of those that were successful and those that were not as successful based on their commitment to these principles. I also think it's important to note this. The corporate sector, the business sector is a leader for the country. And when the corporate sector and the business sector is ahead of the country, it's important more than ever that it stay the course to be able to create the society that we all want to live in. So I am encouraged by those in that sector that recognize that power and that see that importance of the role and that want to be that type of leader.
I think it's so important, as you've mentioned here, about the role the corporate sector plays. We found in our research, in fact, that people trust my employer the most to address issues surrounding racial justice and systemic racism. So to your point, so as business goes, so as employers go, the rest of the world and our society goes. And that's trusting them over government, over NGOs even, and media to address these issues. So I think it's so important to remember the role that corporate America plays in this work and the real power to drive change for society overall. And I agree to your point. I hope that companies will double down, not back up, but will recommit. I do believe that those doing the work prior to the last 5 years will continue to do the work. Those who have been at this and those who recognize the value to their bottom line and who weren't making commitments based upon any knee-jerk reaction to the issues of the day over the last 5 years will continue. That being said, because we know it's such an evolutionary space, what do you think are some of the things that businesses maybe could do? You talked about clarity, but are there any other thoughts about what they should be doing to drive their work, to evolve their programming in this space when we look ahead?
I just have to say the collection of data that's in this report is an example. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, and we are all people that enjoy and appreciate and value evidence-based research. So the evidence-based research that demonstrates the business case for this, that demonstrates the legal case for this, is, I think, really important to continue doing. So one is that evidence-based research, but two is innovation. To be competitive, to be a leader in any sector, one needs to be a visionary. And if one is a visionary, I think that that will inspire the type of innovation that we want to see, and that what these principles represent, they represent innovation, they represent progress, they represent moving forward. So what I see and expect is that companies that value that, that really deeply care about that type of strategic planning, that they're going to lead with these principles in mind, and they're going to be successful. In terms of the attacks in the courts, I think when one looks deeply at what has stuck and what hasn't, despite disappointing departures from precedent by the Supreme Court, I'm confident that we will be in a legal landscape where these practices are protected, and that when those who are motivated to attack progress, when their cases follow all the way through, that they're not ultimately going to be successful. I'm not saying they're not impactful. I'm not saying that the SFFA decision that you referenced about affirmative action wasn't disappointing, both because of its turning its back on precedent and legal doctrine, but also because of the fact that it is just such a denial of progress. Nonetheless, what we're seeing in that sector is universities and colleges that understand it's very important to have an inclusive environment are able to achieve that in ways that are nonetheless consistent with the court's ruling. So it's really about desire, it's about being principled, and about moving forward with innovation.
Forward with innovation, absolutely. The special report also found that people see enacting legislation to reforming police among the top methods to address racism in this country. Literally, that was second to teaching the full history of people of color in this country. This is an issue, of course, you're familiar with, particularly from your time as a public defender. What work do you see in this space, and how do legislative bodies pass and implement these types of reforms?
First, I want to talk about the power of the executive. So what we see is that governors, our president, can really, through executive action, achieve tremendous results. So the Biden administration, for example, introduced an executive order with key reforms for federal law enforcement that were able to be incentivized for states to follow. So on the question of accountability, banning chokeholds, restricting no-knock warrants, improving data collection on police misconduct. The executive order revised the use of force policy to emphasize the importance of de-escalation and a duty to intervene if something is going wrong. And that really created a use of force standard that's a model for states to follow. Restricting the transfer of military equipment to local law enforcement and school police that are not in need of military equipment, and encouraging affirmative alternative responder models when a call for the police isn't necessary. So that action through an executive order that covered both federal law enforcement, but also incentivized states to do the same is really powerful. But there's also steps that legislative bodies can take beyond executive order. States and localities and our Congress can also pass comprehensive reform to improve data collection, to improve reporting requirements and accountability. And this is probably the most important thing that any legislative body can do, is invest in systems and structure of opportunity and safety outside of the police. When our streetlights work, when our community gardens thrive, when people are able to have job opportunities and affordable housing, and our schools are well-funded, that's as much of a factor for safety as anything else. And unfortunately faced tremendous underinvestments for decades, but legislative bodies and executives can turn that around, and we will find tremendous, tremendous progress.
And progress is what I hope we all want, right? That's what we want for our communities, for the states we're in, and for this country. As someone who's dedicated your professional career to fighting for racial justice, what advice would you give to anyone who's trying to make an impact in this space where they are? Any thoughts?
Oh, wow. Well, I think what's really important for us to do is take a look at the progress that has been made. I mean, so much has been accomplished just in my lifetime. My child right now, my oldest, is applying to college, and I'm looking at the landscape of his opportunities, of his vision, of his hope, of his perspective, and it is bigger and broader and more vast than what I had. And I'm inspired by that. And I think one of the strategies for myself that has really helped me is a strategy of hope, meaning hope as a state of mind, but not as a reflection of the state of the world, in that the ability to continue to work for what is good, regardless of whether there's immediate success, but having that long-term vision that those before us have had. And that hope, it really provides me a lot of strength to try new approaches, even in seemingly hopeless conditions, because I really do believe, and history has shown, that opportunity and freedom and principles of justice, they last and they will prevail.
I absolutely agree that we have to continue to be hopeful. And as you stated, hope provides strength even in those hopeless conditions. So grateful for your time today. Grateful for you being a part of this discussion. Grateful for all that you do each and every day. As we wrap up, appreciate you so very much. Thank you for your insights and expertise. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.